Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
I'm going to read a story. Basso was a famous Zen master called the Horse Master. He was the disciple of Nangaku, one of the six patriarch's disciples. One day while he was studying under Nangaku, Basso was sitting practicing Zazen. He was a man of large physical build. When he talked, his tongue reached his nose, his voice was loud, and his zazen must have been very good. Nangaku saw him sitting like a great mountain, or like a frog. Nangaku asked, "What are you doing?" "I am practicing zazen," Basso replied. "Why are you practicing zazen?" "I want to attain enlightenment. I want to be a Buddha," the disciple said. Do you know what the teacher did? He picked up a tile and started to polish it. In China, after taking a tile from the kiln, we polish it to make it beautiful. So Nangaku picked up a tile and started to polish it. Basso, his disciple, asked, "What are you doing?" "I want to make this tile into a jewel," Nangaku said. "How is it possible to make a tile a jewel?" Basso asked. "How is it possible to become a Buddha by practicing Zazen?" Nangaku replied. "Do you want to attain Buddhahood? There is no Buddhahood besides your ordinary mind. When a cart does not go, which do you whip, the cart or the horse?" Have I read this story before?
I have not read that story. I mean, I know that story.
But I haven't.
You have not
given
the
talk
before.
On it. No. That's good. My mom got more and more forgetful as she aged, and sometimes she would tell me the same story every few moments. It was usually about my ex-wife. "Is Beverly still alive?" "Yes, Mom." So I've always loved this story. It's about the unity of practice and the fruits of practice, enlightenment or Buddhahood. So we here in this room probably have some value, some belief, some idea about Buddhahood and the fruits of practice. We practice and then there's supposed to be something good that happens, some like fruits of practice. There's some reason why we do all this for ourselves or for others. There's definitely this sense that things could be better, that things are not that great. There's like the bad stuff, like suffering and war and terrible, terrible things. And then there's the good stuff, the better stuff. Like fruits of practice. Anybody?
Compassion.
Compassion. Mm-hmm. Fruit of practice. Very good. Mm-hmm. Any other fruits of practice, perhaps?
Perspective.
Very good.
Insight.
Keep them coming.
More balance.
What did you say?
Patience.
Tolerance.
Stillness.
Joy.
Equanimity.
Th- Thank you.
Pain.
Did you say pain?
I did say pain.
Pain. I thought that was on the bad side and like pleasure or... But okay. This is a brainstorming session. We accept everything here. And then we have the... So all of those might be sort of qualities of a Buddha, too. All those things. And then we have a Buddha field, not as commonly used term, but my understanding has always been it's like utopia. It's like the Buddhist utopia. Most of us are having those things, and we're not fighting each other or killing each other or raping each other or stealing from each other, you know, as much, or maybe not at all, you know, and it's just like a Buddha field. So I think it's important to remember those things, those reasons, those directions, those values that we have as we start our practice. And the unity of practice and the fruits of practice is important. Because we tend to have this disunity between like the present state that we want to escape from or get rid of, and so our practice has this edge to it that we're practicing trying to get rid of something, and, or we have this sort of franticness about our practice which is different than the fruits of practice. I forgot to tell you, but I did a retreat with a Tibetan teacher.
Okay,
we can talk about that.
That's okay.
Okay. And his name is Sokni, but they say it Sony, like S-O-N-Y. Even though it's spelled S-O-K-N-Y-I. So Sony Rinpoche was really good at making fun of people who had a disunity between the practice and the fruits of practice. And he would be like, I'm doing my practice! Don't bother me! I'm protecting my samadhi! Don't disturb me! I gotta practice! He kept on doing that throughout the retreat, which was very cute. I thought he was very cute. And so we don't want to be that way. We want to have the actual practice have the same nature or flavor as the fruits of practice. And I think, you know, maybe Basso was sort of had that feel about it. I'm in samadhi! Don't talk to me! I think I was kind of like that when I was first at Mount Baldy. You didn't know me then as much, but I like this woman, you remember Marlene?
Oh, yeah.
Marlene once came up to me and said, what is your koan? You're just always scowling. I'd be at the work belt. Stop. Look at everybody. Remember my koan. I'm practicing my koan! But the koans themselves actually were supposed to help us to this unity of practice and non-practice, because they all had to do with relationships. There was a whole series of koans, like how do you love, how do you give your love, how do you manifest your true nature, how do you manifest wisdom, how do you manifest compassion when seeing a butterfly, or seeing a pine tree, or seeing a stone, or seeing a running dog, or a galloping horse, or a cloud, or feeling the wind. All these things that are outside of us that we have to include in our practice. And it also gave me this sense sometimes that even though I like to keep things simple, and I was always just like, koans are stupid, they're all the same, right? They're all just to help us get clear. Why do we need all these koans, you know? But there are all these different situations, and so even though there's a similarity between all of them, and the feeling, the internal and external feelings might be different. They're all the same, but those differences are very key. So we have this idea of unifying practice and the fruits of practice. And Nangaku is trying to point this out to Basso. So we have, who knows if any of these people are really true anyway. So in the story, we're painting Basso as this "leave me alone, I'm practicing" type monk. And Nangaku comes up and I don't think we should think of him as like clever or trying to make trouble or trying to ask riddle-ish questions. He just really wants Basso to have a good experience. Find peace of mind. That seems to be a fruit of practice. Peace of mind. And so he starts polishing this tile. And there's something about the polishing of the tile that I really like. Because it's a movement, it's a polishing movement. And so it sort of reminds me of all of our meditative techniques. We do something. We move our bodies into a more upright position. We move our minds to focus on our breathing or to focus on our thinking. We do things which are movements, like polishing tile. But Nangaku basically says, this tile is already a jewel. Your ordinary mind is already Buddhahood. But we still have to polish. We still have to play these roles of human, making efforts, always making efforts. But when we start realizing that this ordinary mind, this mind we're most familiar with, we're most intimate with, the one that's making the effort, that's trying to become a Buddha, when we get very close to that and we notice exactly how we're making these motions, these internal and external motions, these efforts, then we see that the very substance of those efforts is peace of mind, is emptiness, is shunyata, is effortlessness. And so we can have these experiences where the cart and the horse just move. And who knows where it came from, because it was just a spontaneous motion. It was effortless. And that's the context of these efforts that we make. So we're always going to be in this world of dichotomies where there's a problem, like you have a pain or an ache in your zazen, and you wanna make it go away, so you decide to breathe into it, or whatever you do, all these different techniques that we use. So we split ourselves into the healer and that which needs to be healed. The cart and the horse is sort of like represents all of these dichotomies. But when we're not trying to get away from the pain or the emotional pain or the problem, and we just really become intimate with both the problem and our desire to heal it and our emotions to heal it, then we see that they're the same substance, the cart and the horse, and that they come from emptiness, they come from effortlessness. The very nature of our effort is this activity that shoots through everything, this effortless, spontaneous activity that shoots through, is infused into everything, the so-called jargony dharma activity that Koshin and I were taught so much, the dharma activity, the nature activity, the activity of the cosmos that makes everything, and that is neither good nor bad. That's sort of the confusing thing about the values of Zen. It's like God is not good in Zen. Like, he doesn't have our back. He doesn't give a shit about us, actually. But following the Dharma activity is good for us. So when it's time to die, we just die. When it's time to get sick, we just get sick. The universe is not looking out for us in any particular way more than it's looking out for this notebook. But it is perfect, and it's always changing. So our faith is in that. And then we can all taste these moments of effortlessness. We can all have that as our context and know, okay, that's my direction. That's my value, to follow this perfect activity that changes everything. That's the nature of everything. So they're all, you know, there's all these techniques that we do. It doesn't really matter as long as we focus in on them and have the right attitude about them. And don't disunify between practice and the fruits of practice. So that's sort of the general idea of unity of practice and fruits of practice. And then I thought I would talk about, focus in more on the daily putting that idea into practice. So I want to give a few personal examples. Like, I have to go to the bathroom a lot these days as I get older. So I'm talking to people more than it used to happen. And I'm feeling more and more that it's really time to go to the bathroom. So this is a situation which is not ideal, you might say, within the good and bad world of things could be improved. There's some trouble here. It's kind of on the there's this some trouble here side. So the feeling of anxiousness sort of builds, and the other person is usually talking, and so then I have to make this choice. Am I going to tell them that I have to go to the bathroom, because I really probably should tell them, but then I'll have to interrupt them to tell them that. So it's very complicated. It's very stressful. And sort of, I'm feeling the bodily sensations, and I'm imagining water flowing. I'm imagining all the old men all over the world who are in the same situation and really wanting to go to the bathroom when it's not so convenient to. And then they're talking and talking. And then finally, I say, sorry, I really have to go to the bathroom. That's something that happens to me these days. And I think it's important because there's this moment of choice, and we're making it all the time, and it's one of the contexts of our practice, is that sometimes we don't even know that we are in a state of confusion. We don't even know that we haven't made a clear choice. But it's key, I believe, to be as aware as we can of the fact that we're always making clear choices. Even if it's the choice to be patient, or the choice to not make a choice yet. Each moment of time we're making a choice. I had another uncomfortable situation just the other day. I was at the market, I had to get to the airport, we had to drop off some produce after the market. My helper, Nasser, who was making the juice for me, he said he just wanted to go and get a sandwich. But then he ordered the sandwich and he didn't realize they had to make the sandwich. So he calls me up and says, I'm so sorry, I know you have to get to the airport, but you know, they're making the sandwich. So I'm sitting in the car. And I'm feeling like these piercing sensations of, there's nothing to do. Is there something to do? Maybe I should just leave Nasser at the store. I really have to get to the airport. And then I just decided, okay, I'm going to wait 5 more minutes. And it was, I don't know if I would have kept that promise. Luckily he came out. I don't think I would have left him after 5 more minutes. I might have though, but that clear choice of, I'm going to wait 5 more minutes. Look at my clock. I still can make it to the airport. Then I could just feel the sensations of the uncomfortable sensations that I don't like being late. I think it was my dad's fault. He was never, ever late, as you know. I mean, like, it's has some heat behind it, this not being late thing for me. And so, but then, you know, I had made that choice. I'm going to wait. And so then it was just like, and that's the feeling. And then there's the polishing of the feeling, just being aware of the feeling and breathing with the feeling. And it was, you know, I wouldn't say it was like gloriously pleasurable, but it was much better after I made that choice. And there's the, in all these not perfect situations that we find ourselves in, sometimes we remember to practice. And those moments of remembrance are very important, and I just want to encourage us all to hold them as precious. And they're sort of a glorious mix of opposites for me. On the one hand, for me, I often feel deep regret, sharp pains and pangs of regret. I haven't been practicing. I've just been all caught up in whether Nasser's going to get a sandwich or not, or when I'm going to go to the bathroom or not, or whatever it might be. But then there's also gratitude that I have a practice to come back to. Gratitude for my values, gratitude for all those ideas that we brainstormed about that is my path, and all the people that helped create this path. And I think that mix of emotions, there's something important and delicious. There's this Japanese expression, komata guraini, which when something is just so gloriously delicious that, like, it destroys you. It really, literally means, like, I'm in so much pleasure that it's given me a big problem. but it's like, these mix of opposite important human emotions, somehow they are a gate to emptiness, I believe. Somehow really feeling that mix and not trying to make it a problem that there is a mix, or, oh, this is a paradox, or something like that. Like, it's just this glorious mix of opposites that we can appreciate. And similarly, the first step of our practice, so we remember our practice, and then we start practicing. And I often have that same sort of mix, because there's a kind of excitement to give practice, to do practice. It's almost a kind of generosity, I would say, a kind of giving. You know, the gratitude and then the giving, of the generous giving.
Am I supposed, is that a reference that I missed?
Yeah, because you told me to talk about gratitude and generosity.
Oh.
You're giving me this blank look, and I like bent over backwards to incorporate the gratitude and generosity.
Very good.
But it was easy, because generosity and gratitude, they are very basic. But there's also a kind of fear that we have, I think, if we really look in our hearts, or at least I do, when we start practicing. There's an anxiety or fear or distrust of ourselves that we're going to forget again, or that we're going to do it wrong. And I think actually in both of these very key points, moments of practice, the remembering the practice and the beginning of the practice, part of the fruit of practice, of experiencing these oppositional human emotions, is humility. We have regret and we have gratitude. And then we have a kind of trust in ourselves, a kind of confidence, a kind of thought that we have something to give, and we also have a kind of distrust of ourselves, a kind of a sort of cautionary mindset, which makes for humility as well. And I have a pretty strong sense of the ridiculousness of me sitting in this seat of giving the talk and telling people like how great humility is. And so I'm going to share a little part of a song that my teenage boys, a couple of years ago now, used to sing. And you might want to remember this, you know, in when you're in the thinking about humility sort of mood, and it goes like this. It's a rap. Bar none, I am the humblest. Number one on the chart, well, number one on the list of the humble list. My apple crumble is by far the crumblest. But I say it tastes bad. Out of humbleness. But humility is somehow key. I think it isn't just like the opposite of pride. It's one of the fruits of practice that it's good to remember. So to end my talk, I don't know, have I been talking the correct amount of time?
It's time.
Okay.
It's over time.
All right, excellent. So to end my talk, I'd just like to point out there's a difference between our values and our goals. And I'd like to introduce a perhaps not very common framework around our practice. This is about practice. This talk was about just to see how much continuity we have in this talk, and that has a beginning, a middle, and an end, stuff like that. This talk is about the quality of our efforts and remembering and implementing our practice. And these goals that we sort of brainstorms about being, doing things jewelingly, like they're already jewels, and doing things compassionately and wisely. I don't know if anyone said wisdom as a fruit of practice, but all those are our values. But values are sort of ongoing and hard to measure. But goals, we're in America. We have goals. Yeah, we have monthly goals, weekly goals, we have sales goals, we have all sorts of goals. And people who are trying to lose weight have goals. And people who are trying to get fit have goals, and people who are trying to go to the Olympics have goals. And I'm here to say that I think it's probably like a natural part of human nature to have goals. So why not try it in our Zen practice? But I don't think we should have sort of a checklist of goals. Like, I did my zazen today. I remembered my five times. Maybe it's a character thing, but I'd just like to offer that it's possible to have goals and not have the having of goals burden you. I taught Japanese up here, around here in Stanwood for quite a few years, and one of my colleagues used to talk, he grew up in Japan, and used to talk about his English classes in Japan. And like there's 50 people in the classroom, and they ask you like four questions a class. And you were just like, I want to get it right. And then after class, he was like, okay, I got 2 out of 4. I got 1 out of 4. I got 3 out of 4. Like a batting average. And so he didn't want to teach like that. And he had a very cool teaching technique, which wasn't at all like that. And which was much more artistic in a way, much more holistic. But I just encourage us to, when we reflect on how our practice is going, to have a kind of taste for it. Not like a batting average, not like a list of things that we either did or didn't do. But more like a cook who's tasting the soup. How is that soup of today as we're going to sleep at night? With all the different facets, all the different complex situations we find ourselves in, just how do we taste that day or that hour or that sitting period through the lens of our practice, through the lens of our values? I think it's okay to want to make a richer, better soup and to just make note of it. And somehow in this, I'm trying to push back against this phrase that I'm trying to learn to like, but I really hate. And the phrase is, don't, and the next letter of the next word after don't, maybe this is too big of a hint. Maybe you guys already know what phrase it is, but I'm going to give you a letter. It's a letter B. Don't. What's the phrase? Oh my gosh.
B is the...
B. Don't. Letter B.
2 words.
6 words. Six words. Six-word phrase. 6 or 5. I'm not sure if the last word is a two-word. Oh, okay.
Be a jerk. Don't.
Don't be.
No. So the last word is, this is going to give it away to you, the last word is yourself.
Don't be so too hard.
Don't be too hard on yourself.
Don't beat up on yourself.
Don't beat up on yourself.
Everyone knows it. I was beating up on myself. Don't beat up on yourself. No. Don't beat up on yourself. Everyone says it. So this idea of goals seems to be antithetical to, let's not beat up on ourselves. Mm-hmm. And really, really, I don't want you to beat up on yourself. I really don't. But I think it's okay to have goals. I think the self that was just misbehaving from our own sets of values is the same substance as the self that is remembering our values, and that's okay. And it's okay to gauge our practice in a holistic, artistic way. I mean, to not belabor the point too much, I really do think that People cause themselves a lot of problems for beating up on themselves, for sure. But it is there's a lot of people that do the opposite. They like our current president. He probably has whatever other phrase that we don't use as much. Don't megalomania yourself, you know. It's just a matter, it's just one aspect of your personality. You're either slightly on the I'm inferior side, or you're maybe slightly on the I'm superior side. But let's get over that. And let's just all try to wisely, lovingly move forward and improve ourselves and our world. Thank you. What happens now? A clap? A bell?
No clap or bell. But, I mean, we don't really have much time for discussion. Usually we have a little bit of chat. I want to thank you for a rich soup. There's a lot in there. Just taking a couple of minutes, maybe two, three. Does anybody have any comments or questions for Giko?
What was your goal in doing Zazen this morning?
I had a very specific goal. Someone in my life is very depressed. And she said she's hopeless and hopeless about getting out of her hopelessness. Mm-hmm. So I just made that my koan. Mm-hmm. And I've tried saying all these different things which haven't been helpful. So maybe that's my fear or my lack of trust in myself. But I do want to give her this sense that as long as you're still alive, as long as there's some movement in your life, there's hope there. There's hopefulness. And so that was my goal, to try to get a feeling of how I can rekindle her sense of hope.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.